People who show that determination and that curiosity and that grit and that confidence to just be like, I'm not of this world, but I really want to be a part of it. And I'm here and I'm curious and I'll work really hard. That matters a whole hell of a lot.
I'm Carly Zakin.
And I'm Danielle Weisberg.
Welcome to 9 to 5-ish with The Skin.
We've run into so many questions over the years and had so many moments where we needed advice, and we got it from women who'd been there.
And that's what we're bringing you with this show. Each week, we're helping you get what you want out of your career by talking to the smartest leaders we know.
Because we know your work life is a lot more than 9 to 5.
All right, let's get into it.
Today, our guest is Alex Wagner. She's the host of Alex Wagner Tonight on MSNBC, where she covers news, politics, and cultural trends. She brings her breadth of reporting and journalism experience to the primetime anchor chair, including her time as the co-host of The Circus on Showtime, senior editor at The Atlantic, and former anchor of Now with Alex Wagner on MSNBC. In addition to her career in journalism, Alex is also an author. Her memoir, Future Face, covers her journey and experience with identity, race, and history. Alex, welcome to 9 to 5-ish.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm thrilled.
And Alex is a true pro because she noted the time code of when we were starting this interview, which is how you always know someone is really on their game.
Listen, I know the pain of editors trying to get through tape. You know what I mean? As a digester of tape myself, I'm like, when do we get to the good stuff? Tell me, are we 13 minutes in? Are we 3 minutes in? Just give me the time code.
We are about to get to the good stuff. So look at your time code because we are jumping into our lightning round. Are you ready?
I love it. I'm into it. I'm here for it.
Alex, first job you ever got paid for?
It's babysitting, but like, doesn't everybody answer that question? So I'm going to say it was working at Burrito Brothers. I believe I was 16, and Burrito Brothers was a chain in Washington, D.C., and I was not qualified enough to actually roll a burrito. I just worked the takeout area where I said over and over again for an entire summer, would you like jalapeno peppers or hot sauce with that? And like stood there and put either jalapeno peppers or hot sauce. I put their burrito in a bag and I handed it off to them. I really think that someone was just making work for me. I don't know how I got this job.
So here's a question. Would you like jalapeno or hot sauce on your burrito?
You know what the answer to that is? Both.
Wow.
I am slowly but systematically destroying my stomach lining through high acid, high heat foods.
We're not here to judge. Danielle, next question.
Next question. Speaking of foods, what is your favorite thing that your husband, who is quite the culinary artist, makes for you?
He makes an incredible waffle.
If he cooks, do you clean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's... You know, it's sad. I actually do know how to cook, but at this point, I'm just a glorified dishwasher. But I mean, I know how to get the grease off, so.
Who is your dream interview guest?
Cleopatra, no question. Come on, you guys. Like, honestly, one of the most powerful women in history who's been relegated to being a sexual icon, but was so much more than that. And wow, any day of the week. Come over, Cleo.
I like that answer. You had a memoir that got a lot of support and really nice blurbs about it. But what is one person you wish could write the ideal promotional blurb about it?
I would say Barack Obama, except that he did actually say a nice thing about the book.
So. Humble brag.
No, totally unintentional. But I mean, he did represent in the context of being a future face. You know, he was the first mixed race president of the United States, and I think grappled with a lot of those issues. So, yes, I mean, that was a humble brag, and I sort of unanswered my own question.
I'll take it. Barack Obama for the win. Okay, we got it.
How do you relax?
This is such a revealing answer. There is a company called Glam Squad. And
we are very well familiar with
it. Yeah, we are very
it.
Familiar.
I'm sure you glamorous ladies are. I will have Glam Squad come over. I don't usually work on Monday nights because the inimitable Rachel Maddow is hosting the 9 p.m. hour. Glam Squad will come over after the kids go to bed and they will give me either a manicure or pedicure while I watch a television show. And it's the most amazing. It's incredible. Highly recommend.
That is such a great plan.
What are you binge watching right now?
The Curse. I paid for the Paramount Plus subscription, much love CBS, one of my former homes. It's so dark. Benny Safdie is a genius. I saw Uncut Gems. Did you guys see that with Adam Sandler?
Yeah. Yes.
Amazing.
I almost had to leave the theater. I was like, I don't need more.
It's anxiety provoking, yeah. But it's just so dark and so brilliant.
All right. Last lightning round. Who is the last person you texted?
The executive producer of my show, Matthew Alexander, because I text him about 700 times a day.
All right. There are a lot of different twists and turns to your story. And I have to admit, like, you know, we both used to work at MSNBC at NBC, like, thought we were pretty familiar with your story. But I have to say, something that came up a lot in your research about you that I wasn't as familiar about was your childhood. You grew up in D.C. with politicos as parents who knew a lot of influential, powerful people.
I mean, yeah, sort of.
Sort of. You grew up around it.
Yes, around politics for sure.
When you think about looking back now, like looking to where you got to, like we're talking to today, when you think about what your childhood was like, how do you kind of internalize what those experiences were like and how they shaped you?
Okay, I'll just, as an indicator of how deeply steeped I am in politics, my dad was working on the Ted Kennedy campaign in 1980, which was a very controversial campaign because it was challenging the Democratic incumbent, Jimmy Carter. So anyway, he would come home every night. This is before the internet. And he would call the pollsters for the numbers, the latest numbers about, you know, Kennedy's support. And he'd say, give me the numbers. I was 2 years old and I would stand, when my dad wasn't home, I would just stand on the chair in the kitchen, again, landlines, I'm dating myself, pick up the phone and say, give me the numbers. That's how I would answer the phone. I would play field director for the Kennedy campaign as a 2 year old. It's like, oh, it's in the DNA. I will say though, truthfully, it was so around me. And this was largely because of my dad, less than my mom, who has always been very civically engaged, but wasn't a politico by any stretch of the imagination. I was grossed out by it by the end of high school. I wanted nothing to do with politics. And in part, I think that's why I went into media. And initially, I was in sort of art, pop culture media, not political media, because I wanted to be completely on the other side of it. And my dad was actually pretty vexed. He's like, why write about the news when you can be in the news, kid? And I was like, because I don't want to be in the news, man.
I also like really enjoy this impression of your dad.
My dad has since passed away, but he really had a very unique way of speaking. Like all my high school friends have Carl Wagner impressions that are pretty special. And he was prone to sort of these like one-liners like that one could remember. And at any rate, I wanted nothing to do with politics. And then everybody comes home ultimately, right? So here I am talking about politics all day long.
But in media.
But in media, exactly, my way.
When was the first time you realized that you were good at reporting and delivering news?
That's a great question. I still haven't. No, I will say I had a really strange way of coming to MSNBC. I was working as the White House correspondent for an outlet called Politics Daily, which then kind of got folded into the Huffington Post. And my friend Chris Hayes was guest hosting for the Ed Schultz show, and I did an appearance on that. And the next night, Keith Olbermann asked me to be on his show. And I did one appearance on Olbermann's show, and Olbermann somehow got an email to me that was like, my agent wants to talk to you. And I remember thinking like, whoa, 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 like I've done two television appearances. Like, I don't know that I need an agent. But in short order, like I started doing a lot more MSNBC. And then like, I think it was a year later, Phil Griffin, who was then the president of MSNBC, offered me a job, which is not, you know, it's not like I was some insane talent. It was also a matter of good timing, being in the right place at the right time. But that was probably the first moment where I was like, oh, maybe I could actually do this professionally, this television thing, and be a journalist on air in a way that's different than everything that I've, you know, learned and been taught thus far.
I think one of the things we personally felt when we entered the media world, as we kind of tried to figure out our own careers, is how non-linear of a path it is. And how it was, you know, at the time, so like this is pre the skim, so let's just say like 12 years ago, it felt like every other industry had a very clear path of like, you get in this way, you rise in this many years, and then you get this title. And media, it was not as cut and dry as that. Now, today, like aging all of us, like the world is so different. And I would say every industry like no longer has that linear path. When I look back at your resume, you did not have kind of a linear path to get where you are today. Like, so going back to, you know, I thought I kind of knew about you and, you know, knew the basics from being in sort of the same world. I had no idea that you were steeped in working in music and in working in arts and culture as kind of your entryway into journalism. And so I would just love to hear your vantage point of, you know, I'm sure people come to you for advice all the time around like, how do I break in? When you look at your own path and like how nonlinear it was, how do you reflect on that and how do you kind of pay that forward?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I got my first job in magazines. I was writing for the school paper and I was like, I remember I was with my dad, the inimitable Carl Wagner, keep saying inimitable. And we were in LA. It was like the summer before I graduated from college. And I thought, I don't want to move to New York. Everyone moves to New York. I'm moving to LA because LA is different, but I'm going to work in media in LA. You don't, side note, you don't move to LA to work in media. And I didn't have a cell phone yet, really dating myself, because that was just not, that wasn't what people had. And I went to a newsstand, one of those big like newsstands with lots of titles. And I looked up on the inside pages of all the magazines where they were printed. And there were two like lifestyle magazines that I liked, Ray Gun Magazine and Bikini Magazine, that were both printed in LA. And I literally got a couple quarters and went to a payphone and called 411, which was what you called for information, and got the like number for the publishing company that printed both of those magazines, and cold called them and was like, hi, my name's Alex Wagner. I'm graduating from college in the spring, and I really want an internship with your magazine. Is there someone I can talk to while I'm out here? And they were like, who are you? We don't have internships. But I was like, can I come and meet you? Can I just come to the offices? And they eventually acquiesced and let me come in, and I interviewed, and that led to an unpaid internship, which then led to a low-level editorial job. And the lesson I learned from that, as with other countlessly weird experiences I had getting to where I am today, is, first of all, tenacity, curiosity, don't take no for an answer. And I do think, as much as there's an accepted ladder, like, be creative. You don't have to come at it from the same place that everybody else does, right? I didn't want to move to New York. I moved to LA. I didn't have any contacts in the media industry. I just literally like went to a payphone. And I do think, from the perspective of someone who's hired lots of young people at entry-level positions, people who show that determination and that curiosity and that grit and that confidence to just be like, I'm not of this world, but I really want to be a part of it. And I'm here and I'm curious and I'll work really hard. That matters a whole hell of a lot.
So I want to ask a question that I think I certainly had and struggled with, and I'm sure a lot of people listening also may have, is how do you show that without like annoying the person? Especially like, what is the advice on that fine art of networking where you show tenacity and curiosity and do it in the right way?
Well, I mean, I think you don't want to lose sight of like sort of basic social graces, right? Like, just because, I mean, I think it's like, you need to know you want something, but you also have to understand the other person's perspective, which is they're getting asked a lot for a lot of things, right? You want to think of it as a sort of the same kind of exchange of ideas that you would in any other circumstance. So it's not like you always have to be volunteering your opinion. You don't need to be really thirsty all the time. But I do think, you know, there are ways of subtly showing tenacity and grit and determination and overtly showing them. And you have to have a combination of both. I mean, I remember one of the things about my now executive producer on my show, Matthew, we worked together moons ago when I was first at MSNBC. And one of the most remarkable things about him is we'd have these big editorial meetings and his criticism came at very selective moments. His, you know, you could tell he was interested in something and wanted to do it by the way his eyes lit up. You know, he was just very subtle. He was very, very engaged. He did not need to be the first person with his hands up with a thought. But over time, he became a really trusted barometer of what was right and what was wrong editorially with the show. And I think there are different ways of signaling your intention and your ambition and your smarts. And it doesn't always have to be a giant, you know, banner hanging over your head. Maybe that's not specific enough, but I think, you know, never lose sight of the shared humanity in the interaction.
Something we read, and please, please tell me if we are off base, is over the years, you got a lot of calls from very high profile people trying to work with you, offering you work. You mentioned Phil Griffin, John Podesta, we know. I read, and I please, again, fact check, George Clooney.
Well, George Clooney, it wasn't like George was like, Alex, it's me, George. It was really someone that I had known from college and beyond who was working with him on something else. And we were friends and we'd stayed in touch. And when this job opened up working with Clooney and a couple other names you might recognize on anti-genocide advocacy and activism, he thought of me.
And so you did. Sorry. So George Clooney like just had a thought of you.
No, he suggested to George that I would be a good person.
And George was like,
and
yes,
George
Alex.
Was like, let's meet. And that was, I mean, my heel broke on the way to meet George Clooney, which is just mortifying.
Okay, wait, we got to hear more about that story.
I was just, do you want to hear more about the story?
I actually do.
What did he look like?
I mean, guys, what does he look like? Listen, the camera doesn't lie. That's all I'm going to say. There's a reason he's George Clooney. I was wearing a pair of vintage heels. And
did he ask about me?
He was, actually. It was as if he'd sort of folded time unto himself. Like, he knew that eventually we would be doing this podcast together. And so he just wanted to lay the foundations early.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was wearing vintage heels. And if you've worn a vintage heel, you know they're not always sturdy, shall we say. They've aged. And this one was a sick pair of heels. But on my way up the escalator to meet him in Midtown, the heel broke. I mean, like, what do you do? Like, what do you do? I think I, like, hopped. You know, you can't, like, it's not like I had an extra pair of shoes.
I feel so embarrassed right now. Like, secondhand embarrassment.
Aren't you horrified? I don't think I truly don't think he noticed. Like, I think I got, you know what it was? I sat down and then he came into the room.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm less embarrassed.
So, like, he didn't. And then I, like, beat a hasty exit because what is, like, some... Like, who is this, like, hobo that's come to interview for a job with me? Anyway, I got the job, so he must not have noticed the heel.
It worked out.
Yeah. The heels are gone, though.
So I want to talk about the reality of the hours that you keep being on a show, working in politics and journalism. It's a rough schedule.
Yeah.
You also have a partner and two kids. One of the things that we talk about at The Skim a lot is showing transparency about how working parents manage it, because it's not easy. And I always think it's a myth that people put out there that it is. And so we kind of try to dispel that. How has it been to kind of have the show, and even before the show, you know, you're reporting, it's not a traditional schedule.
Yeah, it's been a life filled with reward and massive crushing guilt, like just so much guilt. It is really hard. I have a 4 and a 6-year-old. The 4-year-old reminds me daily he's about to turn 5. And they need their mom. And like, I also love spending time with them. They're complete like wildcats. Like, you never know what's going to come out of their mouths. And they are also wildcats that are early birds, which is a terrible fit for my schedule. They wake up at about, one wakes up at about 6 every morning, the other one 6:45. I don't get home till like 10:30, 10:45. And you can't fall asleep right after you've hosted an hour of live television. So I don't usually go to bed till midnight, if that early. So I'm a crazy zombie. But the mornings are really important because in the afternoons, I'm often busy with work. And then I go into the office like right around their dinner time. So, you know, I'm just living in a crazy vortex of exhaustion. But I try and really like practice gratitude, because it's really important that I have these children and I have this job and I have this stress, because it's beautiful stress in a way. And, you know, I really try and make things fun and crazy, because that's what you do when you're tired, is appreciate the crazy and fun in a different way. But, you know, I take them to school and then I'm home when they get home. I try and make that happen every day. And then I'll go into work, you know, around, like I said, dinner time. And then I come back home. But it's like there's no two ways about it. It's really difficult. And I constantly feel like I'm sacrificing some part of my heart by leaving every day. But I also, you know, it's a testament to how much I believe in the work that I do. You know, I think the news is really important. I think we're living in a really consequential period in American history. And I feel really thankful that I get to be one of the people that delivers that information to the American public. You know, it's an intellectual trade-off for an emotional debt, which is really, you know, it's hard. It's really hard. And then on the weekends, it's like, I might as well dress up in a clown suit. I'm like, I'm there for fun. I'm there to hang out. Like, what do we want to do? We want to build a pillow fort. We need to make slime. Like, we're going to go to the balloon museum. Tell me, let's go.
What you just described is, you know, the reality of many working parents, albeit, you know, your job is different than many working parents, but the idea of feeling like you're always trying to make a schedule work, exhaustion, blah, blah, blah. I want to take that in a different direction because I find it fascinating that you decided to write a memoir, Future Faced, dedicated to finding out more about your identity, your history, your ethnicity, which is a process of reflection, which is very, very different than the life that you lead in producing television on a daily basis. And that is a really different kind of mental frame to be in. How did you think about that in your career? Did you have to draw upon different skills? I always think, and Carly and I are a good fit this way, that like I really loved breaking news because I procrastinate. So the idea of having, you know, like that much time to reflect like actually gives me huge amounts of anxiety.
I do not work well in that way. I like being prepared.
I'm with you, Alex. I
really
do too.
After like getting pregnant and having two children, the book is like one of the hardest things I've ever done. And aside, like, I don't know, teaser alert, I'm working on another book, which is really, really, really different. But that book was really difficult because, as you point out, it was deeply personal and it was not gathering facts and offering sort of analysis. It was like vomiting forth the emotional like language to describe my family and its sort of, you know, the way it's grappled with the question of identity, just like very theoretical, hazy, nebulous ideas. And I just remember sitting down in front of that blank screen with the cursor was just a form of trauma every day. It was wrenching to write it. But I think it was really important, just if anything, as a psychological exercise, to say nothing of the quality of the book, although I stand by it. You know, it's kind of gutting to have to go that deep. But I think I really came out of it looking at the world differently and certainly looking at my place in the world differently. So that in and of itself as a psychological exercise, I think was useful. But I vowed never to write another book again. And like, look what happened.
What is the next book about?
It's about the radicalization of the Supreme Court in the 1980s and like how we got to where we are now. So it does not require deep emotional
spelunking,
but it's a boatload of research and like, you know, deep archival work. And it's really fun. They're both fun, I guess, or rewarding, I should say, both difficult in really different ways.
You used to be at MSNBC.
Yeah.
Then you were not at MSNBC.
That's true.
You did a bunch of other jobs in the middle that we talked about in the beginning, and now you're back at MSNBC.
Yeah.
Coming back, like, how is your approach different, especially that you've like also just come off of this moment of deep reflection and of deep introspection?
It really felt like coming home again. I mean, I was at CBS, I worked at Showtime, I did The Atlantic, and those are all amazing places. But it's something about, that was my first job in TV. 30 Rock is such an iconic place to work.
We get it.
Right? You guys know, being in the elevator with the SNL cast,
nothing
it's so
like
awesome.
It. It's so cool.
The food and beverage selections in the rink area are extraordinary.
Great.
And like to come back to host a 9 p.m. hour was such an honor, you know? So to be able to go home and then to go have the perch that I do was like, there was nothing bad about it. And like a lot of my favorite people are still in the building. The leadership operation is different, but like it still feels so familiar. And what's changed is I'm so grateful. Like having been away, those were all great places to work, but I really feel like deeply connected to the Peacock in a way that I didn't fully realize until I came back home.
Last question on this, and then we're going to start wrapping up. It's interesting. Rachel transitioned out. You took on the slot, although she's still on Mondays. It's interesting thinking about her relationship with that audience. And then obviously your very different and valuable relationship with that audience. How did you start to think about what your viewpoint was, how you were going to differentiate your take with that audience, and what was most excited about that opportunity for you?
I think the first thing I was just very clear on is like, I'm not going to try and be Rachel because only Rachel can be Rachel, right? And she is a master of the form. It's awesome actually being on set with her when we do these big election night specials because you just see the woman's relationship to the camera, to the teleprompter, to the script, to everything is so unique and specific. And she's just so wildly talented. I feel lucky that I have a front row seat to it. But I knew that, you know, I'd done all these different things in journalism. And one of the things that I think really enjoyed and I think was really additive to the news environment were field pieces. So we've continued to get me out in the world, whether that's going to South Carolina and talking with Gavin Newsom or interviewing Hillary Clinton from her perch up at Columbia or talking to people affected by the latest policies in Florida, you know, as being in the world. So we've tried to introduce, you know, sort of signature elements to the show. But I think just having a different person in the seat means by virtue of that, it's going to be a different show. One of the things that MSNBC does so beautifully, and I'm so thankful for, is the DNA of each host is felt through the hour of television that they host. You know, Lawrence O'Donnell and Chris Hayes and I will all cover the same story sometimes, but we each do it in a different way because our personalities, our opinions, our interests all drive the editorial. So we've certainly had a big year of like growth in terms of figuring out what works in the show, what didn't work in the show. We're into our almost second year in August, I think. It's really evolved. So, you know, I think we figured out what my strengths are as a host, what works best televisually, what's exciting in terms of content. And each day we're trying to get the magic combination that we do. But as far as Rachel, the biggest lesson I've learned from her is approach each issue thoroughly, comprehensively, tenaciously. That's like a theme of what I'm talking about today. And like, don't be afraid to go deep on something that nobody else may be that interested in. Because ultimately, if you think it's urgent and you think it matters, like it's your job and you can help people understand the urgency and the import of it.
So I want to wrap with a question actually from one of our listeners, a skimmer. I'm going to give context to, I think, why they're asking this question. We're in an election year, not a quiet time for news. This is not going to be your year of extra sleep. So the question is, how do you prepare for high pressure situations?
Number one, I always have snacks. Like I have a really good selection of snacks.
Specifically, which ones?
The number one thing I consume is dried unsweetened pineapple. It's like bromelain.
Oh, yeah.
It's an anti-inflammatory.
Yes.
I love pineapple. It's like jerky. I adore it. I go through like 2 pounds of it a week. I always have it on set. Dark chocolate is always important for energy. Unsalted almonds, I would rather they were salted, but you can't have salt all over your fingers if you're on television because how gross is that?
It's a really good point.
And like water. So food is really important. I try and take care of my body with as much rest. I'm a big fan of naps. I try and work out and get my body moving. But more than anything, you know, be prepared. I am relentlessly prepared, probably over-prepared. I try and read everything. I try and talk to people that know things about the things I'm going to be talking about. I see myself as a vessel for the information. And like, it would be irresponsible not to come on those big nights with my AA plus game. So I try and do that.
Final question. Who's someone else we should have on this show?
Oh, my Lord. I think you should have Gretchen Whitmer on. I think you should have Gert because I think she's a rising star, but more importantly, she has managed to do something really difficult, which is, you know, really dominate a complicated state with grit, with integrity, and like a fierce red lip everywhere, always. This like incredible, like glamorous side to her as she's doing this really, she's like up in there in like a crazy political fight and is just steely as hell.
I also got to ask about the kidnapping plot.
Yeah, I was like, we got to ask her about that.
I mean, the subject of a kidnapping plot.
Yeah, we got to throw that in with the red lip. It all works together.
And by the way, let me say, and is dealing with an attorney general who's a woman and a secretary of state who is a woman. So like when you talk about how women are doing it, like just really interesting dynamic over there in Michigan.
Alex, thank you. Great to have you on.
Such a pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9 to 5-ish with The Skim. A new episode will be in your feed again next Wednesday. And if you want to keep up with us in between episodes, follow us on Instagram at Carly and Danielle.
It's a really good account, I promise.